Now you see why I told Senator Mona Sanderson that she's my favorite senator.
Absolutely.
And that is now on the record, Representative. Good afternoon. I'd like to open the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness.
Again, a good afternoon. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. And Senator Boquist, he told me as we were coming down here, if we want to get out of here next week or soon thereafter, he needs to be in the Revenue Committee because that's where all the action is happening. So he's going to be there, and when he's done there, he'll come back, but he may not be back. Do you have any opening remarks?
Wonderful. Just to say that, once again, this is part three of the three-part series regarding our resilience plan. Appreciate for those of you that will be testifying. We try to stay on the timeline if we could. Keep in mind that if we get off the timeline at the initial part, it extends the day beyond, and that's not an option. So we need to make sure that we stay on task, and appreciate everybody being here. And I know that my good Vice Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, and my senator would like to start us off with a reading from her book. So if you would.
Again, I would like to read from it's called When Janie Comes Marching Home, and these are portraits of women combat veterans written by combat women veterans. And this is written by Ensign Colleen Fagan, U.S. Navy. And she says, deployment teaches you a lot about survival and teaches you a lot about cultural awareness. It also teaches you about what other women around the world are going through. I have met women in burqas. I have met women who were following behind men. I sat outside a mosque at a cafe table one day and just watched people go by, and it really makes you aware. I learned a little bit of Arabic while I was over there. It really teaches you that it is one world. It's not the U.S. and the rest of the world. It's one world. And it really kind of crashes down on those ethnocentric attitudes that we have. There is a lot of arrogance within the military and in the civilian community. And I think by forcing yourself into situations like the military or deployment, it breaks all of those barriers. You really find out, wow, that person over there is just trying to feed their family just like me. I think it changed me in that aspect. I've always been very liberal-minded, but it really hits home when you talk to people. And I talk to everybody over there. I mean everybody. I would talk to women, men. It's amazing. They just want to talk to you. They just want you to know that they are not looking for battle. They're not looking for war. In my generation, I think there's a real lack of leadership and a real lack of responsibility. And I think that going through the deployment and the military thing, it really heightened my sense of awareness that I need to be just as much of a leader as my people, as the people in my dad's generation. Thank you.
Thank you. And so we will begin with the information meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness. And this is an informational meeting. And again, we'll start at the top of the hour. We have introductory remarks from Kent Yu. We have telecommunications with Mike, is it Mumwa from City of Beaverton? And also water and wastewater from Michael Stewart. On deck at 205, we'll have Vicki McConnell and Ian Maiden from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. So with that, please begin. And Mr. Yu, if you would please. Dr. Yu, you could start. And if you would please state your name for the record and kick this thing off for us. Thank you, sir.
Great. My name is Kent Yu. I'm the current chair of Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. I want to thank Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee for inviting us back to testify on the remaining chapters of the Oregon Resilience Plan. Mike, it's all yours.
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews and Vice Chair Moens Anderson. I am Mike Mumma. I am the Emergency Manager for the City of Beaverton. I'm also a Commissioner on OSPAC, and I chair the Information and Communications Technology Work Group for the Oregon Resilience Plan. The information that our task group focused on is work on the wireless and wired infrastructure for communications and information systems that provide services. Got to remember my slides.
And it's working today. So, and if it
that's a plus.
If it should go down, we are prepared. It is emergency preparedness, so we do have hard copies for you too. So feel free.
So we looked at the wired communications and information system as well as the wireless, particularly those that provide services to businesses, municipalities, and individuals. For the purpose of the plan, the system components include central offices, remote terminals, internet exchange points, wireless cables, those both above the ground and below the ground, and outside plants like splice cases and repeaters. It also includes, coastal cable landings and towers and antennas. The resilience goal for the information and communication systems is to provide the immediate emergency communication needs after an event, followed by phased restoration within specified time frames. Two items should be noted at this point about the goal. First and foremost, resilience is achievable. As demonstrated in Chile, resilience can be achieved within a 50-year period without a heavy burden or unrealistic amount of new investment. Resilience does not mean 100% functional after an event. It does mean, however, building a system that can be restored within those specified amount of time to achieve those levels of functionality that are desired to support the response, recover operations, as well as support restoration of the economy. In order to determine the current level of resilience, we took a look at the system as it exists today. We looked across all the information and communication technology systems and platforms that support the voice and data communications. During the research, we found several inherent seismic vulnerabilities in the current systems, the biggest of this being the interdependence with other sectors, particularly ones that you've heard about and you'll hear about today, but energy, providing electricity to provide this, to power the systems, liquid fuels to maintain the vehicles and the generators, transportation, you need roadways to allow access to the sites for maintenance and repair, and business continuity to ensure that skilled staff is available to repair and restore the systems. Other inherent seismic vulnerabilities that were identified in the current system include bridges, which in addition to conveying vehicles over geological features, convey utilities, including cables for telecommunications infrastructure. As noted in the transportation chapter of the resilience plan, a large number of these bridges will be damaged or destroyed during the scenario event. Wireless communication systems include antennas that are installed on leased spaces on office buildings that the communication providers do not own nor control. These locations were selected based on coverage and demand requirements, not on the stability of the buildings or their location outside hazard zones. Many facilities were designed and constructed before seismic design standards that are in effect today, reflecting the current state of knowledge on the seismicity of the region before they were established. Essential facilities, including central offices and towers, are often located in areas that make them vulnerable to damage, from liquefaction, alluvial soils, landslides, or the tsunami. So as I mentioned before, there are some target frames that we identified, or time frames we targeted for recovery. We established these based on the needs of the other sectors, particularly business, where they said that they had to have telecommunications infrastructure in place and some functionality within 2 weeks. The targets were broken out into three levels to assist in establishing priorities for resilience and restoration activities and projects. Minimal, which is a minimum level of service being restored, primarily for the use of public safety, responders, repair crews, and in support of critical health and human services, or mass care. Functional, which is not quite full pre-event capacity, but it's a level sufficient to start the economy again, start commerce, allow banks and businesses to start business, including credit card transactions. And then operational. Still, it may only be a 90%, but it's robust enough and restored to a level to allow support or entertainment value or what we might consider luxury items, but the Facebook and the other aspects that we heavily depend upon. So a comparison was made of these target areas, along with the estimated times and the current time frame or current conditions of what it would take to achieve it. We did this within four geographical areas, as was discussed in previous chapters, but the tsunami inundation zone at the coast, the non-tsunami inundation zone at the coast, the Willamette Valley or Central, and then Eastern Oregon. And we noticed that significant gaps exist, and the slide just shows an example of what some of those gaps are. Under current conditions, the recovery times can be years, especially in the tsunami zone, and as well as wherever buildings or large infrastructure are destroyed and need to be replaced. Based on this, we have some policy recommendations that we'd like to present. And you'll find that these are very similar to other sectors that have already presented, especially the energy sector. These recommendations include: sector companies should conduct seismic vulnerability assessments on all their infrastructure facilities and work with the appropriate agencies and stakeholders to achieve timely completion of the assessments to understand what the existing vulnerabilities are. An oversight authority like the PUC should be designated, and such organization may need to define the criteria for that vulnerability assessment. The result of the assessments should be reviewed, and the system's reliance on other natural disasters also taken into account. Companies in the sector should also institutionalize long-term seismic mitigation programs based on the scenario earthquake. Again, it's not a 1 year, it's a long-term effort that we're looking at here. Sector companies should be also provided a liability waiver. The language should provide for vulnerabilities identified in the seismic vulnerability assessment that are above the operator's current normal criteria requirements. And then Oregon's Office of Emergency Management's public-private sector position should be utilized to help ensure coordinated planning, information sharing, interoperability exists among the critical organizations and agencies. The position will also ensure that the work being performed by this entity is in partnership, helps provide public education outreach to local, county, and state agencies and other organizations. The state of Oregon should also provide statutory authority for a prescriptive waiver of routine permitting requirements and processes for the design, construction, and restoration of communication information infrastructure, if it is, however, determined that the waiver is in the public interest and is necessary to address an actual or impending emergency caused by a natural or man-made disaster. In closing, Chair Rhett Matthews and Chair Vice Chair Moens Anderson, I appreciate your time and the committee members as well. Thank you for the opportunity to present the information and communications technology recommendations from the Oregon Resilience Plan. As with the other sections of the plan, increasing resilience of the communications information technology system requires that we conduct a new assessment of our infrastructure. We make new capital investments to improve performance of critical structures and systems. We develop appropriate incentives and engage the private sector partners. We also consider the policy changes needed to fine-tune the existing state policies. And I'd like to urge you to use these four overarching priority areas as a guide for your legislative decision-making as we begin a long journey, a 50-year journey, towards resiliency in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes, I believe there will be.
We have a lot of new capital investments that we're going to need to have. And have you started prioritizing so that, you know, we don't have a lot of money? Maybe there's federal money, but is there a plan for implementation using and a plan of where the money should come from, whether it's general fund, whether it's feds? I mean, can you give me a sense of where the money is going to come from to make us sustainable when the tsunami hits us?
Chair Matthews and Vice Chair Moens Anderson and members, at this point, we're not to that level of detail. The biggest step at this point is to take an assessment of all the infrastructure, and not just telecommunications, but energy, and find out where the greatest need is. And at that point, we have a better chance of identifying what the priorities are and where the funding streams might be.
I just get a little nervous because if we have the tsunami this summer, and we haven't even begun to start dealing with some of the problems that we will have. You know, I don't know if there's low-hanging fruit that we can start dealing with now in telecommunications or in bridge, you know, taking care of some of the bridges, et cetera. But you just say we're not at that level
yet. We're not at that level yet.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Biscobel.
Yeah, and when we talk about this, I always think of catastrophic earthquake out in the ocean, and not only will it take out our infrastructure on our roads, but it's also going to take down radio towers. It's going to take down most everything and isolate. My concern is isolation of the coast itself. We have to be more or less mobile on this, wouldn't we? We wouldn't be building infrastructure to be like towers and things of this nature. Wouldn't we have to have a mobile type radio system and a mobile type way to get supplies in and out of the coastal region? And also, have we worked with our local chapters of our shortwave radio clubs and things of this nature? Because I know they can drive and be mobile and utilize their services.
That's correct. It's a multifaceted. So you have emergency response, and a lot of that work has already been done. We saw a great example in 2007 windstorm, where it was the amateur radio operators that actually started the doing public safety dispatch when the 911 system went down. So a lot of that portion is in effect. The other part of that is also your telephone for general use. There's, you know, contingency planning versus, again, building a resilience infrastructure. You can build towers situated on hillsides that can give you coverage over the coastal area, and they'll be outside the inundation area. You just have to look at the standards to build them so they don't shake apart or fall down. Or, you know, they get a little misaligned, you can realign them. Again, as part of that time frame, you're not looking for 100% resiliency. So, yes, you would be looking for a basket that combines resiliency of infrastructure, where you can have it and where you can keep it safe, and then contingencies using amateur radio, deployment packets for radio kits. There's some of those already in existence around the state that are, I believe, maintained by ODOT that have trailers and additional radio communications.
Well, sure. And what my concern is like I was saying, the earthquake part of it, because, you know, I've been in an earthquake of 6.5, which isn't that bad. But you know something? You couldn't stand up. And if it's 10 times worse at 7.5 and 10 times worse than that at 8.5, and then half again as much at 9, that would be a real doozy.
Yes, sir.
And I don't think you'd have any much infrastructure left at all.
But again, as they showed in Japan and Chile with their recent large earthquakes, they showed that you can build a level of resilience in your infrastructure to survive that quake.
So you think our towers would remain intact and our electrical?
At the current design standard, no.
Yeah, okay.
That's why we need to do an assessment and actually, I would say, model it to see if they would design.
But I guess my question is, would it, instead of building into infrastructure that may fail or it may not fail, which some of it obviously doesn't, would it be better if we concentrated on mobility of those services?
So the mobility part becomes problematic with the liquid fuels. If you lose the availability of liquid fuels in Oregon, then you can't airlift or move your packets.
Well, but you would lose the ability of liquid fuels and something like that anyway, as you cut off the whole area.
True. I mean, it's hard to look at just one aspect of this whole plan and come up with a solution. It has to be taken in a holistic approach and prioritized.
And I know I read funny stuff. I understand that. But the other thing, follow up. The other thing is, what would happen if we had similar to a how would we handle a situation of where we had a solar flare that I remember in 1865, I think they had one, 1866, that took out all communications for a period of 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
1865.
How would
you remember that in 1865?
Yeah, I was there. By the way, if you want to know what Ulysses S. Grant was like, just give me a call.
That is a whole other area that needs to be looked at, because it's a different area of resiliency that's not part of the seismic design.
We're going to bring this back around here in just 1 minute, but Senator Olson.
On one of your slides, you showed that to be functional and operational, you had time frames. What did you use to model that so that you could say that in 3 years this would be back to operational? Do you have examples? I mean, like Chile and Japan, you bring that forward all the time, but we don't have that same preparedness. So,
right, what we looked at was the parts of the system, and so if you're looking at having to rebuild a structure, and depend in the tsunami inundation area is the, if you will, the long pole in the tent, because you have to reestablish your infrastructure before you can even start rebuilding. So that drives the 3-year time frame, and in some cases we didn't even put a time frame for the tsunami inundation area because it's hard to figure what that's going to look like. But if you're looking at placement of towers and building of buildings, even this day and age, you're looking at 1 to 3 years to get it permitted, designed, and built. So that's what we were looked at is what would it cost if a central office, a exchange point collapsed totally and had to be rebuilt. And so we looked at the 1 to 3 years on that.
Follow up. I can understand that you're probably, I think you're describing communications. What about the rest of the infrastructure? I mean, how did you plan repair roads, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, like if we're talking the tsunami, what happens if we have a major earthquake right here in the valley? We're probably looking at 5 years to repair that mess.
We tried not to make it too dire.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think now would be a good point just to make sure everybody understands in the audience and our viewing audience at home, which is millions of people. We recently passed out, we received Senate Bill 33, and we amended Senate Bill 33 in the House. Initially, it was just modified list of state agencies to designate the liaison for emergency preparedness and response. That was modified in the House and has passed the House now. And now what it is, it's related to emergency preparedness, which gave us the right to do that. It's established a 17-member task force on the resilience plan implementation. This whole thing is very overwhelming. The commission's work is overwhelming. And if you look at it as one chapter at a time, you can still get overwhelmed. And to discuss what's going to happen on the coast versus what's going to happen, you know, rural Oregon, those are all things that need to be considered. But I'll just read just from the quick measure summary that the bill will create a 17-member task force. And I understand, by the way, that Chair Boquist has agreed to concur on the Senate side. So we'll have this opportunity. But the 17-member Task Force on Resilience Plan Implementation, in order to facilitate a comprehensive plan to implement the Oregon Resilience Plan, as reported to the legislature during the February 2013 legislative session by Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, for responding to the consequences of naturally occurring seismic events associated with geological shifts along Cascadia subsection zones, specifically educating and training our community leaders in emergency management and resilience practices, and coordinating investments in equipment, facilities, and critical systems for enhanced resiliency and survivability. It goes on to say that all this, occurs, that 17-member task force will be due to report in front of our committees by October 14. So it makes a lot of work in a short time to address some very critical issues. Nothing answers what's going to occur if this all happens today. It doesn't address that. But I do know that, sir, you're the Director of Emergency Management for Beaverton, is that correct?
Sure.
And so, you have counterparts in Gresham with Kathy Harrington, Kelly Ondefazo, some of these folks. I know that there are emergency managers right now that have plans for their communities. It's getting everybody together to figure out just what exactly we have in place and how we coordinate that activity that's going to make the difference for Oregon citizens on how we respond to that disaster. So I commend your work and appreciate your efforts. None of this should be too much because it's, as they say, and I don't necessarily say it, but I will repeat it, in terms of how you eat an elephant. It's just one bite at a time. This is a very big issue that we are addressing. And in this session, we're addressing it through a 17-member task force. Now, if we can get concurrence on that, which I think we'll have in the Senate, then that gets us on direction to prioritize and start moving on this great work that your commission has done. So appreciate your work. And Dr. Yu, does that kind of sum it up with you, too? And you understand that as well?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Now, Representative Boone, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let people know that for PennWare this year, the summit in Anchorage, which is mid-July, and PennWare specific Northwest Economic Region, which is 5 states and 5 provinces and territories in Canada, who address various issues, this being one. And I'm on there. It's broken into different issue areas, and I'm on disaster resilience and ocean policy. And in disaster resilience, we are going to be having a section on the Oregon Resilience Plan, and Jay Raskin is teed up to attend via, not Skype, because apparently that's not going to work, but some sort of video conferencing. And I am going to, with the Dr. Yu's permission, make a PowerPoint or cobble together from what we've got on OLIS from these last three hearings here, and whatever else, if there's a 10-minute version of something, but have a PowerPoint, they want that. I want to disseminate any material anybody wants disseminated. Dr. McConnell's going to be beaming in as well from her purview. We've got a good lineup. So we will be, this is like another step in our march toward implementation of this, and it'll be sharing it with five other states and five provinces and territories, not all of which, I mean, like Northwest Territories does not have to deal with tsunamis, but the everywhere from Canada, you know, BC, Yukon Territory, and Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California, although California is not in PennWare. But we will share the information, and we will do all we can to keep up the movement forward. And what we do is we'll be getting whatever they're doing, if they're doing anything, which I know Washington State, Alaska, and BC are doing right now. We will be able to get their information and give it to the group that Senate Bill 33 is setting up and help them move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Any further questions of the panel? Thank you very much for your time today, and have a safe trip back to Beaverton. Appreciate your work. And next up, I think we have Michael Stewart, is it, from Water and Wastewater, Portland Water Bureau.
This is another bite at the elephant, so to speak. good afternoon, Chair Matthews and Vice Chair Monis Anderson and the rest of the committee, particularly Debbie Boone, who's come and talked to our Orworn group. Thanks for letting us come and talk to you this afternoon about our last year's work on the Oregon Resilience Plan. There are two co-chairs. I didn't do this by myself, for sure. My other co-chair was Mark Knudsen, who's the chief engineer and soon to be the CEO of Tualatin Valley Water District. We co-led this effort. Our whole committee had 24 people on it, some of which I've listed on the slides, a range of academics who have technical competence in this subject, utility groups, public interest groups, consultants, and emergency management professionals. And we spent the better part of 8 months working on this. Obviously, we're talking about the subduction zone earthquake, magnitude 9, and about 3 minutes of shaking. Like all the other chapters in this, the thing is divided into four zones, and had we all followed somewhat the same approach. I wanted to talk to you for a minute about why water and wastewater systems are so vulnerable. It's somewhat like the energy systems. Tsunamis nail us because we tend to be in low spots, and we've got pipes and treatment facilities everywhere, particularly the sewer systems. They tend to be run by gravity, and the low spot is along the river or along the coast, so the treatment plants and so on tend to be in the places you might least like them to be from the respect of a seismic event. Shaking, we have very rigid facilities, and they don't do well with shaking. Ground deformation, landslides, earthquakes, and something called lateral spread that's not listed, basically drag the pipes and make them all pull apart. So the systems themselves are hugely vulnerable. They're very large. They're very complex. I'm the chief engineer of the Portland Water Bureau. We cut a 35-mile swath of Portland, of the north coast area, and we go from the mountains to down beside the river and up into the next mountain range. We hit every kind of topography. We've got pipes basically running under every street, as do the sewer systems. We have them running alongside rivers, liquefaction zones, and so on, and down into the coastal area. Location matters a great deal in the kind of damage that you get in an earthquake. We're also uniquely vulnerable because we're very dependent upon all of the other what are called lifeline sectors, energy in particular. Energy I usually think of as electricity, and I would particularly mention fuel. I think you've been briefed on that. Fuel is a very, very big deal in our state. We don't have enough of it, and we don't have it distributed very well, and we can't move it around very well. But we must rely on all of those things to operate our water systems. We need electricity to run the pumping plants, treatment plants. We use a lot of fiber optic cable, which is in duct banks, which are very much like pipes, to actually control these systems, and so on. Our systems are old. The average age of the pipes in my utility is about 60 years, plus or minus. I have pipes in the system that are doing quite right fine right now, thank you very much, that were put in 1895. They will not do well in an earthquake because they're made out of cast iron. So age matters, location matters. We have much better materials to use now than we did. If you look at the four pictures that I've got before you, these are from various places around the world. They're all recent earthquakes. The photos are explained in the Oregon Resilience Plan. I can tell you where each one's from. But the pipes pull apart. They also compress and buckle. That big bump you see in the lower right-hand corner is a sewer system that floats when liquefaction happens. Why does it float? Because mostly it's empty. It's like a balloon sitting down there. So when the soil liquefies, it floats, and that's what's lifted the sidewalk up.
That would be a bicycle hazard in Portland, wouldn't that, sir?
we would have people very, very aroused about that, I'm quite sure. Another major challenge for water and wastewater systems is we go from being in the ground, we pop out of the ground, and we connect to a rigid structure. And that structure doesn't move in the same way that the pipes move. And unless you've specifically designed that connection to handle that kind of movement, what you have is a break. So in my own utility, for example, I expect that most of our tanks will have broken pipe problems where they connect to the distribution system. Those are things that you can design for. Although sometimes you may not make the system immune from that, you can force it to break where you can get at it. And that's part of resiliency. You can't make anything immune from a magnitude 9 earthquake. The deal is, how resilient are you? How quickly can you get back up and running? Another real puzzler is what you see on the slide before you, leaks, breaks, and so on. Every street in every city has a water pipe and a sewer pipe running down it. So I've showed you pictures of the pipes moving. Well, if you go to a residential street, every one of those houses has got a line attached to the pipe that's in the street, and those pipes break. Not only do they break, but the old galvanized lines that are attached to the house break. So even if your water main was in good shape, and even if my part of the water service was in good shape, beyond the meter could break. So you have to be able to shut that off. What happens in this regard is very quickly you lose all the water in the system. And that's a hazard. Both you don't have a potable water supply, but one of the things you need in the immediate aftermath of an earthquake is generally you have a few fires to fight. And the risk here is that you're going to lose your firefighting capability. So what we were tasked to do is the same as all the rest of these groups. We had to figure out what's the goal going to be and where are we at. And I'm only going to show you one of these pictures. Down the left side of this picture is the components of the water system and the components of the wastewater system. So we decided the red, green, and yellow are what we wanted the goals to be. Green is 80 to 90% operational, yellow is 50 to 60% operational, and red is 20 to 30% operational. And across the top is how many days, weeks we expect to get there. There's not a great deal of science in this. It's mostly judgment of people like myself who've been doing this for 35 years, and you figure out how much is going to break and where do we think we can get given the kind of material that we could use if the world was perfect. So that's how we established the goals, the red, green, and yellow, and that's the goals. The black X's are where we're at today, and therein lies the gap. And I'm going to show you a different graphic that's maybe a little bit simpler to look at than this one is.
So.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask?
Absolutely.
Yes, ma'am.
This is, you know, something I hadn't really thought about, and will, in part of the planning that you did, is there an educational component to water users on what to do in an earthquake regarding their water supply?
I have a recommendation at
later
the
on.
End
okay.
that we'll briefly discuss that, but mm-hmm. like Mike's presentation previously, this is pretty high level.
Yeah.
It's pretty accurate as far as it goes, but it's pretty high level. So we figured out what our goals were and where we were at, but how did we get to the where we were at? I think the state is really lucky in the folks that we have in Dogami. Not that I want to give a plug for Ian Maiden and company who are going to talk to you, but they have done an awesome job of taking some fairly accurate stuff produced by FEMA and enhancing it and making it really usable. And because we cover such a wide swath of ground, we're interested in two or three different things, and you can see them there on the slides. Ground acceleration matters, landslides matter, and liquefaction zones matter. And so the where you're at and the how big those numbers are, and something I didn't put on there that I wished I would have put on there, is duration. Duration matters. 30 seconds of shaking is very different than 3 minutes, and 3 minutes is a long time to shake rigid structures. So we looked at all of that. Go ahead. And we decided, and we made estimates. Now, there's some fairly good statistical models to use that are based upon a great many earthquakes that have happened in, say, the last 15 or 20 years. And it's called the seismic fragility information. And you can get a very good cut at how many main breaks you'll have, for example. Now, I can tell you, for my utility, for example, and I'm going to show you a chart in a minute. Go back. My utility, for example, we're probably going to have about 1,500 main breaks. That 1,500 main breaks will take place in 3 minutes. Boom. That's pretty accurate. What I can't tell you is where they'll be. That matters a lot. I can overlay Ian's tricky products, and I can tell you where things are more likely, like liquefaction zones or landslide zones, but I still can't tell you exactly where those will be. I wish that I could. And from that data, we estimate service breaks, and it's just kind of a fudge factor, but that proves to be pretty accurate. Go ahead. So what you see here is six utilities. This was all a volunteer effort. We didn't have the money to go out and do a study and get a real database. But we took six utilities that were willing to share data. And there are some very big utilities in the state in there. And there's a coastal utility in the state there. And I just assume not say who they were because we have security concerns with that.
Sure.
And we compiled all our data and we applied the fragility numbers. For the utilities involved, it looks like we're going to have about 3,500 main breaks. That is 3,500 main breaks in 3 minutes. There'll be 24,000 service breaks. That's a lot of work. And if you wanted to put this to scale it for any utility, you could do so. It's about 16 years worth of main breaks for any size utility. We all use basically the same things. Depending on how old they are and where they are, there's some variation there, but the estimate is a pretty good one. And the 3 months that we show there to repair that number of breaks, that just assumes the time it takes us to repair an average main break. It's not repave the road. It doesn't take into account whether we could get there or not. That's a big deal during the earthquake, or whether we have fuel. It's just a straight calculation of 3 to 4 hours, crew hours, to repair your average main break and multiplying it out. So it would take longer, depending on, of course, on the number of crews you had. Go ahead. Now, something that's may or may not be obvious, but the age of these facilities matter for a couple of reasons. One's the technology that they were built from. One, in our case, is pipes, so corrosion matters. The older they are, the more likely they are to have corrosion, and that means that they will be weaker. But how these things were designed matters greatly. If you look at this chart, it's got age down the left side, and down the bottom, it's got a bunch of shorthand for facility names. This data is real data that came from a utility who will prefer to remain nameless, but I think it's representative of what would happen statewide. For things that are 15 or 18 years old, they were designed 1990 or later. They've been designed underneath the current earthquake codes. They will do very well. Things that are older, like 1960s or before, there's no real seismic code back then. And so these facilities are probably problematic. I consider them in our utility, they will probably fail completely. In between there, you can't say that they're going to be good or bad, but you need to go look and you need to make an analysis. Depends upon what assumptions the designers made. So for the data that you see there, and I think it would be reasonable to use this statewide, it says that one-third of the pump stations will have major damage, one-third some damage, and one-third minor. Now, more importantly there, across the top, you can see how long we think it takes to fix them, and you'll see some big years out there, 3 years. It's not because we couldn't fix them if we had the parts. Big pumps, like I have 350 horsepower pumps, you don't go down to Costco and buy them. You order them. So if you have heavy damage to pumps, to what we call motor control units, the electrical gobbledygook that hooked the pumps up, motor control units, all that stuff is custom ordered for high horsepower stuff. And you would have to order them. And in this size of an earthquake, the whole coast would be in the same shape that Katrina was. So another way of looking at the goals, it's maybe a little bit easier to see. On one side, you have available capacity. And at the bottom is time after the event. And you can see there, if you follow the, let me use this tricky gizmo here. Say you were looking at the coast. Takes a little bit longer to put the coast back together. We're recognizing that as a goal. And the green line is Eastern Oregon. There may be some damage over there. It's a little hard to predict. But in the main, you're going to have busted windows and so on is what you'll have. The valley, you can see where that is. Maybe somewhere between 3 and 6 months will be probably 90%. But this particular puzzle in here, the business community would like everything back up and running in 2 weeks. And I think that would be a nice goal, but it's not one that the wastewater and water group was willing to sign up for. We don't think we could do that. So what we did for our group was say, we're going to limit this to the backbone, that we can get a backbone up in 50 years. And in my case, what's the backbone? It's a huge amount of piping that has to be replaced. New connections at every tank that we have. We're in the process of replacing open reservoirs right now, so that should be taken care of, God willing, and the creek don't rise. But we weren't willing to sign up to be able to have the water system and wastewater system up in 2 weeks. And this is particularly difficult for the wastewater guys. They have a different problem. It's a good news, bad news story. With a water system, it's under pressure, so when it breaks, you can find it. In a wastewater system, they run by gravity. So if the underground pipes, which you can't see, get little bumps in them, that restricts their ability to flow. And you may not find that you've got a problem for 2 or 3 months after event as the usage goes back up. So they have a bigger challenge in trying to figure out what's going on than the water system does. Our breaks are really obvious, and you can go find them. Go ahead. This is what we think the existing condition looks like today, and the one thing that I'll point out there is you don't see anything in the tsunami zone. We don't believe that the water and wastewater systems will survive the tsunami zone, and we certainly don't believe that anybody would put them back in the tsunami zone. I think that's a real challenge, too, because wastewater systems in particular tend to be at the lowest downhill point in a community. So if you're on the coast, your treatment plants are probably right there on the coast. May not be true for water systems. We tend to want to take advantage of gravity, so the treatment plant is as far up the system as you can get it in terms of elevation. Go ahead. So what did we conclude out of all this? There's a significant gap between goals, what we want to be, and where we're at. If the subduction zone quake occurred today, we would be having a heck of a busy time dealing with it. There's just no other way to put it. Water systems are generally better prepared than wastewater systems. That's the consensus of the group, not necessarily my opinion. Eastern Oregon would have limited impacts. The tsunami area, from our perspective, would take years to recover, if ever. The coast is critically impacted, up to 1 to 3 years to get our kind of system put back together, and the valley, 6 months to a year, depending. Go ahead. Resiliency upgrades will improve recovery times. Much of what you see, and I know that this is overwhelming if you're not used to dealing with it and thinking about it, but the Japanese started a long time before we did, and their systems do fairly well, given the energy that's put into breaking them, more or less. And we're where we need to bite the elephant off one bite at a time. And current design methods can put us in a much better shape. And if one of the risks in this is thinking about, oh, shoot, we need to fix this tomorrow. You can't fix it tomorrow. All you can do is look at the 50 years and make a plan. And that's what I would encourage the legislature to do, is hold the rest of us to a plan. And that's the best that we can hope for. The cost will be significant, but they can be managed if you think 50-year time horizon. Recommendations. This is the one that the senator asked about. Reset public expectations for recovery times. Right now, everybody talks about a 72-hour kit. That is not enough. And I think if we had a public information campaign to square with our citizens. We have a state full of outdoor people. We're tough. And if we make them aware of what we need to prepare for, I think they'll do it. I'm a backpacker. I've got probably 5 of those per filters, microfilters. There's a water supply for you to drink if that's what you need to worry about.
Kaden, is that what they're called? I think that's...
Oh, they've got a variety. They're microfilters. There's some are ceramic.
99.999% of everything.
Dave Leland back there could probably talk all day about filtration. But I would have the 2 state regulatory bodies that regulate the water and the sewer system encourage utilities to join OREWARN. That's the Oregon Water Wastewater Response Network. It's a voluntary network. But there's legal agreements that need to be in place for utilities to go spend significant amounts of money helping another one. And it gets people talking together. There's a database there that shows what kind of assets are available. And the legal agreement is in place. You don't have to mutz around doing something to create it. Require seismic assessments for all systems as part of periodic update of master plans. Both the sewer bunch and the water bunch report to state regulatory bodies, and we have to keep the state regulatory bodies apprised of our master plans and put the requirement in there that we must address in those master plans this 50-year effort where we are supposed to be resilient.
Now, do you mean education to the families regarding seismic upgrades they should make?
No, I'm talking about the regulatory bodies who regulate me, for example. I work with OHA on a regular basis, and so I'm talking about the utilities and the regulatory agency that regulates them. Require OHA and DEQ to require the respective utilities to complete formal seismic risk assessments and mitigation plans. It's a little bit more than a master plan, as part of their periodic updates. And we have regular interactions that take place with both regulatory bodies. I'm not personally so familiar with DEQs, but we have something called a sanitary survey. And basically, the drinking water program comes out and goes through our system with us every couple of years. And we report back, and they tell us you need to fix these things. And we step out and fix them, because we have to be, if I don't know what the right word is, licensed to operate. And that permission comes from OHA. Require OHA and DEQ to include seismic design as part of system design. Major capital programs, in the case of me, Portland Water Bureau, all those major projects have to go to OHA and they review them. They review the designs and the calculations and so on. So it's an easy step for them to say, I want to see seismic stuff in there. Same thing takes place with DEQ, although I'm less familiar with that. Go ahead. Last but not least, encourage public health agencies, water and wastewater utilities to plan for significant water quality impacts to the Willamette and the Columbia Rivers. We resist talking about this. In this kind of an earthquake, we are going to be causing pollution in both rivers. What do you do about it? You can't tell somebody whose sewer system does not, their treatment plant's non-functional, but they're collecting the sewage, you want it out of the city, or you're creating a public health problem. You can't tell them they can't open the gates into the river. That's a heck of a trade-off, and we ought to think about that and know what the heck we're going to do. Same case would apply somewhat to the water system. The way we deal with small disasters in a water system is we issue a boil water notice. Well, let's see. The gas system doesn't work and the electricity's out. What the heck good's a boil water notice? What are we going to do? In my mind, it's better to push untreated water through the system than have no water, because the bottom line is you have to drink a certain amount of water every day, whether it's good or bad. So there are emergency response things that take place in that regard to provide minimal amounts of drinking water through the emergency response network. But this is a longer puzzle than a few weeks. So thank you all very much for letting us talk to you today. I'll endorse what Mike Mumma said at the end and encourage you to step your way through this, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much for your time. Questions?
Thank you, sir. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
This is a suggestion on the water part. You can get a Berkey water system that'll produce 11 gallons per hour. Pour your bad water in it, and it produces 11 gallons per hour.
Yeah, it's a real challenge when you think about, okay, everybody needs to drink a certain amount every day.
Yeah.
One of the biggest uses of water is we actually drink very little of what goes through the water system.
Well, we waste more of it than we...
Well, you have to move the waste is what it does. It goes down the toilet. And I'm sorry, that's a very, very important function. I'm sticking up for the sewer guys. It's really important how you deal with that. So, any other questions, sir?
Any other questions, panel? Yeah, Senator Olson.
When you did your big pipe project, how did you design for future tsunami or future seismic events, or did you?
The big pipe, you mean the sewer pipe?
Yeah.
I'm the water guy. I don't deal with this dirty water, clean water. But it was designed in the last 6 or 8 years for current code, and I think it will be fine. Some things will break and so on, but it's a matter of how much steel you put in the concrete liner and all that kind of stuff. But it's properly designed. The challenge for all of us is we've all got old infrastructure. I've got infrastructure that was built in the 1890s and early 1900s. It was great, and it was built to the best knowledge they had at the time. And nobody had a clue about earthquakes very much, and certainly not the subduction zone earthquake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to remind us, we heard a presentation from Cleve and Tamara Helm, who I met at your conference, with their water purification system that they have, portable system. And I've since heard from him and got an email today saying he's met with people in my district, and especially at Camp Rylea with Colonel Perez, who's taking over that command there now. And he's also works for the county, but a lot of people are kind of getting that word, and he's able to connect with some of the smaller systems. And I don't know the number of gallons they can produce, but I think it was pretty good for what it was at the time, too. So
they have a big unit.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't too big. It's backpack size. I mean, it's like the size of a portable keyboard is what I had described it. But anyway, it could clean up to 99% of the water, including Giardia and cholera, I believe. So that's going to be a big issue. You mentioned the water and the shape it's in. You know, I'm not saying that we're at that level, but a lot of the countries around the world deal with that every day, and their people are relegated to drinking water from mud puddles, and that's why they're sick all the time. So it's a lot of work in water policy around the world, and we can learn from what they're doing in some of their applications, which is why I go to that CWEF conference every year. So,
Representative Escobel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How long would it take us to recover? I remember back in 1964, not 1864, Mr. Chair, 1964, that we had a heck of an earthquake in Alaska. And I remember seeing pictures where part of the street would be 6, 8, 10 feet above the other part of the street. And I talked to a fellow that was in the earthquake, and he said, yeah, your side would go down, then it'd go up, and then it'd go down. And but how long would it take us in Portland, let's say, to recover from something of that magnitude? Because that was an 8-point-something.
The Anchorage earthquake you're talking about, I think it was also around a 9.0. That's my recollection. Is that 9.2 magnitude. Yeah.
Well, anyway, how long would it take to recover from something like that?
Well, on that front, it depends on which sector we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that is, we have summarized that in the executive summary. We have a table on that. It's not a comprehensive table, but it give you some idea how long it would take to recover. And, you know, the as we talked about previously in previous hearings, you know, the critical piece is the liquid fuel. And if we lose that, I don't know, you know, what can we do without the recovery and response? So,
I mean, it must have taken them years to fix that mess.
So if you look at the water system, Mike has been talking about today, is that we are looking at 6 months to a year. You know, assuming he has the 16 years worth of main break happening within 3 minutes, and that's assuming everything is fully fine, it's going to take him 3 months to fix all of it. Mm-hmm. So you know, you do the math.
Any other questions? Seeing that, gentlemen, thank you. And we have some work to do with the public, obviously, and getting them to reduce their expectations. I've been asking my wife to do that for years, and it's not working, so we'll see. Also getting the public to realize that they can be responsible for their own hazard mitigation, too. So learning how to shut off your own gas, how to shut off your own power, how to shut off your own water, and your neighbors would be very helpful. And again, to the millions of viewers out there in our audience, think about looking into your local government to find out where the next class is on that. So, or ask a firefighter. They seem to know some things. All right. Well, next up, Department of Geology from Dugami.
This is Dugami, just say it.
Dr. McConnell and Ian Maiden, thanks for being here today. And this is where we meet into our flash rounds. These are about 10 to 15-minute testimonies, and I appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Matthews and Vice Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, Dugami. And with me is?
I'm Ian Maiden. I'm the chief scientist with Dugami.
And we'll flash through this. What we're going to do right now is talk about, we're going to show you what the elephant is. We've been using that analogy all day. We're going to take bites out of it. And so that's the last time I'm actually going to use the elephant analogy. I want to use a different one right now. What we're going to do is talk to you a little bit about the science, what we know about the science behind the whole scenario for this resilience plan, and where we really need to go with what more we need to know about it. So the new analogy is, if we're going to build a resilient Oregon, we need to start with a strong foundation to build that structure on. And that's what we're really talking about here, is that foundation is the good science behind understanding what the problem is and how you get your arms around it. We're the science geeks, so you're going to have lots of images and maps, so you have to start thinking in that visual again. So what we're looking at here is just a little reminder. Here's Oregon over here. Here we are. Here's the Pacific Plate. Here's Japan right here. If you look at it in cross-section, we are the mirror image of what happened in Tohoku, Japan in 2011. So that gives us a good foundation of understanding both the science and really what do we expect to be the impact. So that's where we kind of base a lot of this work on. One thing I did want to say is I wanted to acknowledge that the scenario working group, which was the chapter one for the resilience plan, was made up really of a blue ribbon panel group of scientists around the country. Many of them, though, do their work here in Oregon. We had Oregon University professors. We had state experts in tsunami and seismic work. We had the private sector experts as well, and we had the U.S. Geological Survey. So you really had the best minds working on developing this scenario. So what we want to do is just quickly go through some of the earthquake research timeline. So we're going to start out here in 1700, where there wasn't a lot of research going on, but that's what's triggering all this interest we have. And we're going to compress that timeline a little bit. So 1700 was quite a different place on the Oregon and the Oregon coast than it is now. And we didn't even really start to see big changes to even 100 years later when Lewis and Clark first found their way to the mouth of the Columbia River. If we think about what Oregon looked like then and now think about what it is now, the coast is very developed. It's developed right down to the ocean line. The Willamette Valley is now both the economic driver and the breadbasket for the state and the nation. We have a lot more vulnerability than we did in 1700. These are some of the other activities, natural resource hazards that's happened over the years. We've had several earthquakes either in the area that have taken human life here, or we've been impacted, for example, like the 1964 that Representative Esquivel was talking about. That tsunami from the earthquake that occurred in Alaska killed people here on the coast from that because we were not prepared. We didn't even know it was going to hit until it happened. We really have not been responding to seismic hazards since the 70s, and it really wasn't until 1972 that we actually had a state seismic code. At that point, we didn't even recognize the Cascade Subduction Zone was active, so the seismic code simply did not require a design sufficient for the hazard we have. At that point, we're looking at about 55% of the Oregon building stock alone had already been built to substandard seismic. So it wasn't until the late 80s that the science community really started thinking about what is that impact, what is that elephant that's out there on the coast. And we had several academic studies. They really think that there was a possibility of a great subduction earthquake. That's actually when we started our tsunami or our earthquake hazard program. However, it was not until 2000 at a Penrose conference, which is a science conference, that the science community in general agreed that the Cascade Subduction Zone was active. So by then, we have 88%+ of the building stock in Portland alone has been built to substandard seismic standards. And it's not really their fault. It's because the science was scrambling to keep up with what we actually start to now really understand. And finally, in 2012, Professor Goldfinger releases his history, the paleoseismic, that we really started to understand the scope and we could start to understand when and how could we expect things to happen. So let me quickly go through what we know. This is what we base the scenario on. And again, this is only a scenario. This is not exactly what we think the impact would be. There's been 40 Cascade Subduction Zone earthquakes in the last 10,000 years. Some of them have been those big ones. Some of them have been not as big. We can look at the average over time now and get a repeat time, which is the important thing to understand when you're planning. That's where we get this, that the 9.0 events averaged about 530 years, but there's a big spread in time. So we can't nail it down and say we know it's going to happen in 50 years. We can just give you a probability of what that happening is. That is one of the fundamental aspects of this kind of science is we can put our arms around it somewhat, but we can't nail it down and we can't predict. And we know the last one happened January 26, 1700. We know that there will be a tsunami that will occur. We can look at what happened in these recent ones. These are images from Tohoku. Many of you have seen these. We know that the damage will be extreme in the tsunami inundation zone. And I draw your attention to this image over here. This is a map from some of our latest inundation mapping. This is Rockaway Beach area. All those little black dots are buildings, actual buildings that are really in Rockaway Beach. This light blue here shows what the inundation of that community will be in the magnitude 9 earthquake. And that gives you an idea of what this would be like in an area like that. That's the information that we can supply to help you make the planning, is what are the impacts going to be like. We know that there'll be what they call co-seismic subsidence. That means that the coastline and the sea level are going to change immediately, and they're not going to come back that way. There will be a new sea level. There'll be a new coastline. That's going to affect everything from estuaries to river drainage. We don't even really understand completely what all the impacts from this will be. This is a model of what we think the subsidence will be, as much as 8 to 9 feet on the north part of the coast. That will have profound effect on everything from ports to estuaries to, as I said, even how the rivers drain. We know that the strength of shaking will vary widely, and that really depends on where you are and what you live on. We have a pretty good idea on soil types. You've seen this zonation now. That's how we've kind of zoned things out based on the impact. We know the shaking will last 3 to 5 minutes. That's 10 times more than the typical earthquake in California. You've heard very learned people looking at their systems to tell you what you think that amount of shaking. So even before tsunamis or anything else, we have to think about what this shaking. We also know that there's different types of soils that will enhance what that shaking will be, depending on the geology and the geomorphology. And the better we can nail down where these are and what the expected damage will be, the better we can help these folks design their systems. We know there'll be what's called liquefaction and landslides that are triggered by the earthquake. This is a map that gives you an idea of where the susceptible areas are. Heaven forbid everything in the Coast Range decides to fall down into the ocean. So this gives us an overview of where the susceptible areas are, but it doesn't give us enough information to help infrastructure design on where do we know exactly where those are going to be. There's work to be done. Same with the liquefaction, which will primarily be in the valleys. So the working group, the scenario working group, really came up with three major recommendations where the applied science should go. One of them is research on the effects of specifically this type of earthquake and tsunami to Oregon's landscape, population, buildings, and lifelines. More detailed and accurate estimates of damage and loss, which we can start to get our arms around now. And provide ready access to the best available earthquake information for all those people that need it, responders, the planners, and our general public. Because as we've said, there's no reason not to know. You can plan for something if you've got a pretty good idea what you're planning for. But if you don't know, you're not able to make those connect the dots and really make the good decisions. The Oregon State agencies and universities have the capability. There is the talent and the knowledge and the scientists out there that can do all of this work, that can do all those measuring and mapping and modeling, ground shaking, landslides, inventorying and assessing the buildings, looking at the vulnerability, everything. What we don't have is the capacity. And part of that capacity usually equals what's your investment? Where is the funding going to come in to invest in that? Primarily where most earthquake seismic and tsunami research goes on at the basic or the applied level right now is from federal input. The National Science Foundation, much of the universities have National Science Foundation research that they're doing now. It's basic. It's not applied. It's very important, but it's not going to get us right to what we need for the resilience plan. And that is all that NSF funds. They do not fund applied science. things like the National Earthquake Hazard Resilience Program, which is what we typically apply for funding to do some of our applied research, and we have one in, we have a proposal in with them now to enhance some of our hazard viewing capabilities so that people can go on and type in their address, and it'll show you right there what is the hazard in your area. That's very limited funds, and we have to compete with all regions in the country. We need to get our arms around what we need for research and information. You've heard a lot of that today with what other groups say they need. A lot of it is assessments and vulnerability studies. We need to compile what's already out there so that we're not reinventing the wheel. We're taking what's off the shelf but making it usable to what we need it for. And we suggest we need to coordinate further research and information for the resilience plan. Now, I'm not about to say that we should tell researchers what they want to research. That's their business. But when it comes to getting the resilience plan implemented, we should have a good idea on what the research that's going on and how to further that research and information. And we can do that's part of our mission. We can help to coordinate all of this. Wrap our arms around it if given the capability to do that. And I guess I'll point back to this, and I'll say one final thing, and that is, as you've heard from all the other scenarios, there's the four big issues. We need those assessments, need to think about what incentives are that would incentivize particularly the private sector to want to step up and get involved in this. Capital, you know, there's going to have to be capital investment somehow to think about this. And as you've heard from several folks and in several areas, there's some basic policy discussions and policy changes that would really help with this resilience. Thanks. And happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you said that the coastline will drop 8 to 9 feet.
That's correct. There will be a graduation, not the whole coastline.
Okay.
Mainly, we think the north will. It's going to really depend on how that earthquake actually, as we call, rips apart. But there certainly will be a change in the coastline.
So how far inland from the current water line do we expect it to shift inland?
Well, that's one of those basic elevation topographic questions.
Sure.
If you drop your sea level down 9 feet, that means everything after that changes. You have a new sea level elevation.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it drops 9 feet there, that effect will be, that's global, basically. But the actual effect of what will happen will certainly affect all of Oregon, all of the Northwest, really.
We can answer that a little more quantitatively. Other studies of beach erosion related to sea level rise from global warming suggests that for every foot in elevation, sea level rise, relative sea level rise, and that's what this will look like when mm-hmm. the land sinks.
Yes.
Instant sea level rise.
You get 25 to 50 feet of coastal erosion. So it might be hundreds of feet of erosion.
And so will there be places where Highway 101 will be underwater?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the realtor and the speculator are working together here.
I'm trying to sell his property.
Yeah.
<his oceanfront. laughs>
That scares me. So 25 feet, excuse me,
yes.
Follow up, 25 feet of distance per foot of drop?
25 to 50 feet.
For what?
25 to 50,
to
feet,
50 feet
of inland movement of the coast for every 1 foot that you drop.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any further questions for the panel? Thank you so much for your time and testimony today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your work. Absolutely, our honor. And next up, Public Utilities Commission, Lori Coho, please. Appreciate everybody staying up on time. It's really helping us out to get all this information out. It is, again, the third of a series of three meetings, and sure appreciate everybody having their testimony ready. So thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews and Vice Chair Moss Anderson and members of the committee. I believe that you were here last time when I testified 2 weeks ago, and the slides are going to look painfully similar to what I did last time because the first slide is an overview of the PUC's safety responsibility roles. Did I identify myself? I'm Lori Coho. I'm the administrator of the Safety, Reliability, and Security Division at the Public Utility Commission. So the first slide is an overview of our roles. I'm going to zip through this, and the second slide, can I get through these? Oops. Thank you. Should be able to just do it as an arrow. Okay. And the second slide is showing what our responsibilities are in the event of an emergency and our disaster response activities that we participate in. As we did on the energy section, we participated with the telecommunications section on the OSPAC report. We have worked with our utilities. We do expect them to do seismic assessments, and that we try to work with them in what those recovery methods might look like for those investments. I think the thing that has made sure the utilities know that we are very interested in them reviewing their seismic preparedness is the couple of workshops that we have held, and we plan to do that on an annual basis where they can present updates to the commission and to the public on where they are in looking at their seismic resilience. And again, that's a way to reinforce our interest in them doing those investments. That we expect them to do those vulnerability assessments and to prioritize and make those investments appropriately. The thing that has come out of the workshops and is consistent with what you see in the OSPAC report are all of the interactions and the interrelations that exist. And that is for any of these services to come back up, as there has to be adequate transportation infrastructure. Certainly there needs to be restoration of electrical power to essential telecommunication facilities, available liquid fuel, certainly timely restoration of the gas pipeline services. Rebuilding of infrastructure, and again, the in relation to rebuilding of infrastructure and response are the issues around permitting and the liability issues that we've talked about before. One of the other key points I wanted to make is that the Public Utility Commission regulates basic telephone service and rates and service quality. That does not include cable. It doesn't include wireless. It doesn't include a lot of the methods of communication that we're dependent on at this point in our, technology. And so we're talking to a subset of the communication facilities that people are used to. And so I just wanted to make sure that the committee was aware that when you're talking about what the Public Utility Commission can do now and the people that we're having the conversations with, that it is a subset of those communication facilities that you're expected to having access to. That was my zip through it really quickly presentation. Do you have any questions for me?
We appreciate the work and the work you're doing on the commission. Any questions? Let's go. Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With a magnitude 9 or greater earthquake, is there any reason to believe that there will even be a gas pipeline left to restore?
It's hard for me to get my arms around a magnitude 9. I would say that our gas infrastructure is in much better shape in this part of the country than you would see in other parts of the country, because in general it's a lot younger. And the Public Utility Commission has worked with Northwest Natural already to do some seismic upgrades to their pipeline. They have replaced all of their cast iron. They are close to being complete in replacing all of their bare steel. And so the places where we would have material vulnerabilities, so bare steel would be subject to corrosion, so those things we have been replacing, working with them to replace. So we're in much better condition, but is anything going to survive that 9-0? It depends on how it hits and how things move. We've got the pipelines that are associated and attached to other facilities and infrastructure. We're very dependent on that. We've got our supplies that are coming across the Columbia. You know, are we going to, you know, what are we going to have there? It's so dependent on where it hits and how it hits. But I would say that our pipelines, we have done a lot of work to get them in better shape than we would see in a lot of parts of the country.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you. Were the pipeline or lines to rupture, is there a way to shut off the gas, or will this continue to feed fires until the pipeline is, in essence, burns itself out?
I can't say in every condition, but in the majority of the pipeline infrastructure, there are automatic shutoff valves that are sensing pressure fluctuations and will shut those supplies off on large pipelines. The smaller distribution pipelines, you may have to get somebody on site to actually shut a supply line down, but the major lines have automatic sensors in them to shut those down.
Do we have any experience from Japan or elsewhere of the efficacy of these automatic shutoffs post major quake?
I'm sure that information is available. I don't have it with me. I can't recite that back to you, but I can get that information for you if you and the committee would like.
That'd be great.
And if you thank you very much.
To Ms. Ross, is that? Yes, thank you.
And absolutely.
She'll get to the committee. Appreciate that. Any further questions? And I'll just say, my brother lives in Oklahoma City, and he just recently went through their disasters, and I could not communicate with him by phone, his cell phone.
Yes.
But I was communicating by text through the phone, which I thought was really odd. For someone that was from the Portland area, he was just amazed at the devastation that occurs and how quickly that can happen.
Yeah.
Spent about 3 or 4 hours in the basement on day 3 of that, so crazy. Thank you for your testimony today, and thanks for joining us. Now, from Office of Emergency Management, Dave Stuckey, newly appointed Director of the Office
of
Emergency Management. Congratulations, Mr. Stuckey, and great to see you here, sir.
Well, thank you for being here, or inviting me. Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey. Pleased to be here today, although it's generally more pleasant to be here and speak prior to DGAMI. But they do have some hard-hitting facts that need to be addressed, and it certainly is something that we don't want to hide from you or anyone else in this state of ours. It is, as I stated, important. This is our highest risk hazard. Senate Bill 33 does provide a great opportunity to continue the work of over this 170 volunteers to develop the Oregon Resiliency Plan. Our next step to be a part of that task force is very, very important as these critical decision makers come together and develop this implementation strategy. And as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, we're looking forward to providing this policy framework as necessary in order to get this back and produced in front of the legislature in October of 14. I have observed the last two information sessions with this joint committee as you've grappled with these critical actions, and what we tend to do in emergency management is just try and break it down a little bit, both in planning, mitigation, response, and recovery. And so this resiliency topic is large, it's important, but we try and break it down into those four cornerstones. The recommendations of this resiliency plan, identifying our most vulnerable interdependencies between the critical infrastructure, the response to lifelines, and the delivery of services is really important. What I'd like to do is take a brief moment here to discuss some of our planning, the OEM's planning backbones that we have within our office. Volume 1 is our preparedness and mitigation. It includes the natural hazard mitigation plan that you heard speak to from Oregon Partners of Disaster Resiliency, U of O, last week. It is really that backbone for mitigation for what we have at this point in time, and it certainly not doesn't address everything, and the resiliency plan and the implementation will certainly take a greater priority. Volume 2 is our emergency operations plan. We continue to develop these new incidences and annexes to the EOP based upon gaps or vulnerabilities or new threats that exist. Last couple of years, we produced the new annexes to address nuclear and radiological incidences following the HUCU EQ. Immediately after that, we kind of scratched our head, pulled this annex out and said, this doesn't cover it. And so we got a planning group together real quick and produced the new nuclear radiological plan to just respond to those types of incidences. We've also have a disaster aviation plan, the tsunami marine debris plan that many of you are familiar with. And then our latest development, at least right now, ongoing is the cyber annex to cover those threats. And so all of those kind of get wrapped up. And then our last volume is the relief and recovery. And so that's kind of our breakdown and our structure as we help shepherd emergency management within the state. What I'd like to do right now is show you a quick couple of slides on our response plan. So for the last year and a half, we've been developing a parallel track on response. And so many of your questions tend to go from response to mitigation to planning. And what I'd like to do is explain what we've done here on the response plan. In the room I have is our main planner. But what we have done is we basically developed in coordination with the federal plan. And you may have seen this a couple of years ago. FEMA took on the new MADRN, brought in all the states and locals to try and figure out how to respond to that type of earthquake. We did that in a different approach, a little bit more holistic approach with the federal partners, states, and the locals inside the state of Oregon, which is really what produced this plan itself. And so it covers all these states, and of course Idaho as a support role. And then our final products are our response plans. Next slide. This is kind of where we were. It started with this whole piece right here on impacts and analysis and modeling. We had to pick a point on what the threat was. Now, FEMA contracted and produced some threat hazards. DAGAMI's generally prevailed in our state in how we mesh those two together to at least decide on what it is. And so our response plan is based on a 90EQ. We have a lot of the similar products that DAGAMI had in developing this plan. And so what we did is a series of outreaches, and we started with states and state agencies. And we just simply said, okay, what do you have? What are your gaps? What are your vulnerabilities? What is the list of stuff that you bring to this response? And then we move forward with the counties, and then we produce this plan. Well, this plan isn't complete yet. It will never be complete. We'll always be in the process of refining it. But as we as you move forward here, where we're at right now is resource allocation. And so from the standpoint of not complete is we have all these assets that exist out there in both federal, state, and county level. But what is it that we need to do in order to start tasking those resources based upon the threat that was identified? And I'll get into those course actions and that resource allocation a little bit. I would like to offer that at least in the response piece, FEMA is looking at an exercise that we certainly endorse somewhere around 2016. Don't know if it's going to be a national level exercise of that magnitude or scope, but we got to test it. We can't just send back and let it sit there on the shelf and collect dust. Next slide. Our plan consists of basically three components. There's a handout that you have when it talks about the objectives and actions and tasks that I'd like to draw your attention to. For example, what we try to do is we try to standardize this across all the states. The thought process, at least at the FEMA world, is that if Region 10 isn't going to be responding to this, they're going to be coming from another region. So there has to be some continuity within our entire region in order to help this response efforts. We'll be having Idaho coming in and helping us also. And so there's lots of different methodologies, but we stuck on one. And we basically stuck with objectives and then actions and tasks. And so there's a series of objectives. The first one on save lives and ensure public safety. There's a number of actions within that, but one of them is establish air transport. And you've debated this issue in the and asked this question in the last couple of weeks, and we'll continue to, but then we have a series of tasks underneath it on whose job it is in order to establish that and how are we going to get that complete, both in use of the aerial assets, loading and unloading, and as we continue down, not to mention just the fuel component. And so that's kind of the scope in which we developed this base plan. And then we have, of course, the emergency support functions and then the county response plans, which at this point in time, we started with the appropriate seven, the coastal seven, and Washington County, and now we're just kind of moving from north to south, and we'll cover the Willamette Valley and then work our way back up. Our intent is to get up to the Cascade Mountain Range on county plans and the integration of those plans with the state plan. Slide. Resource allocations. Our planner went to one of the first meetings, and this is the bidding. This is the hard part where we want to make certain that we get, Oregon gets its share. And an example of that resource allocation, there are 11 national USAR, urban search and rescue teams in this nation that they originally allocate. There's more than that, but there's 11 they initially allocate to this problem. And so who gets them? Who gets them first? And so at this point in time, at least in that initial discussion, it's California 1, Washington 5, Oregon 4. The same applies to mortuary affairs teams and who gets those. And so it's just a list of these are all the assets and this is who's going to get them first in accordance to this plan as the feds start completing their plan itself. Slide. That really concludes the response plan in a nutshell, Mr. Chair. And so what I'd like to do at this point in time is we have is open up to questions, but in close I'd just like to say that we have multiple planning tracks here, both in resiliency, response, mitigation. We're going to have to merge all these together at some point in time, and we certainly are a big part of that. And so at this point in time, I'll see if there are any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? So you mentioned the urban search and rescue teams, and I guess I'm curious, what's your read on what becomes of those in the future? I understand that there's several local jurisdictions that are having a hard time paying for those teams. They've been given the equipment. They've been given the initial training. But there's also costs associated with the training itself and maintaining the equipment. And the money's kind of the well's going dry. Any concern that we have as a state that these teams might not be available and jurisdictions might end up saying we can't continue to maintain the USAR team?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a concern. Two components to that. As when I was discussing the national teams or the teams from out of sector, that's not necessarily Oregon, but I understand your concern because did meet with Oregon State Fire Marshal's office a couple of weeks ago when I returned to the job, and they have basically decentralized those USAR teams that we have, and we're basically operating with one in the Portland region and then one in the Eugene region, primary alternate. And it isn't enough.
Yeah, we are. I mean, Gresham has one. Of course, Gresham, Clackamas, Walton Valley, but
all part of one.
The problem is that they're starting to peel off where local jurisdictions are saying we can no longer afford to maintain. And that's kind of difficult. I know the State Fire Marshal's Office, the HAZMAT team approach has done really well, and that's funded. I'm just curious about USAR, if these are something that we might end up losing at a time when we need them the most. Absolutely.
Certainly think that that's a potential task that we could draw in this task force, as we move forward, because I mean there's going to be a series as we talk resiliency of response as well as mitigation, and you know the original, speaking just for myself, you know there's puts on response that we're going to have to cover until the takes of mitigation start taking effect, whether that's in critical infrastructure, in resourcing or whatever the case may be, and so we want to be able to cover that gamut to ensure that we're prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, and I look forward to whatever exercise they're coming up with as well, because as you know, the top-off exercise exposed a great deal of what we knew and where we had to improve and what we could do better.
Sure.
So very good. Well, thank you, sir. And with that, we will just say again, congratulations on your position as director, and wish you well, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Have a great day. Could we please then, from the Oregon Health Authority, have David Leland come forward, please? If I could give gold stars for staying on time, I certainly would give those to everybody today. Thank you very much. It makes it much easier on the committees behind us. Thank you.
And I intend to continue that trend. So,
absolutely.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Leland. I'm the drinking water program manager for the Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. Glad to be here today. I'd just like to say, really, again, kudos to Mike and his group for, I think, just an excellent effort at analyzing the water wastewater situation. And I know my colleague from DEQ will be up here in a minute. And just really an excellent job, given that overall assessment, and really gives us all, I think, a lot to think about. And there were some recommendations there to the regulatory agency. You know, I run the regulatory program for safe drinking water quality. And, you know, those are all doable. You know, and I think would be beneficial, really making sure that when facilities are designed, they at least touch that base of the seismic design. And you know, there's, you know, we're not seismic experts, but you know what? There's plenty of geotechnical structural engineers out there that the water systems employ to do their master plans and construction. And I think that's just, those are excellent recommendations. Another thing that really caught my ear in the discussion was Senator Mona Sanderson's comment on educating water users. Because, you know, I'm not sure people know that there isn't going to be any water for a long time. And, you know, there's really going to have to be some community resilience around a lot of things. That's just one of them. You know, and in fact, I think there's really only you know, one example in my experience of a pretty good-sized community with no water and wastewater that I can remember, and I've been doing this about 25 years. So, and it was that flood down in Ashland in, I think, the late 80s. Although I have to be careful because things are always farther back than I remember them. So maybe I went the opposite.
Or maybe it was 1964.
No, it wasn't that long ago. But all kidding aside, there was a major storm event on the snowpack up on Mount Ashland. There's a huge flood and mud coming down the hill. Took out the brand new water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. You know, took out the wastewater plant. And so we had a community of thousands of people with no water, and so there's a big, you know, now the, you know, the Oregon Emergency Response System kicked into gear on that. And, you know, they actually employed their citizens go around, shut the water off to all of the houses to keep some water in the tanks in case there was a fire. And then, of course, you know, the National Guard brought in the little water trailers, you know, and parked them around town, and a lot of porta potties around town. And, you know, they got through it as a community. You know, they were pretty darn resilient. Of course, that's just one community. And if they're all like that, then I think communities really are going to, you know, going to be relying on themselves for some time. So I think it's well taken that we make sure there's at least local information. What do you do? What do you do for water in the meantime? And this morning on the way down, I heard a story on NPR about Kenya, where they've been drilling wells for villages and all this engineering stuff. But then turns out, you know, the water's still bad. And so they're trying to get people to use bleach, you know, when they go and get water and then, you know, fill their, you know, their container. And hopefully it's a decent container, and that's another issue about water safety. And use the right amount of bleach and store it properly when they take it home. And they're having a real challenge with that. So, you know, I think that's kind of where we'd be at for quite a period of time after a major event like this. So, anyway, I would just say, just give you a couple of things and I'll get out of here. There are 3,500 public water systems in Oregon. And it's everything from City of Portland, the big one, you know, down to, you know, handful of houses on a well. And while maybe 50 of the largest water systems maybe serve 70 or 80% of the state population, you know, 90% of these public water systems serve less than 500 people. And so, and a lot of them are going to be broken in a big earthquake event like this. So that'll kind of give you a little perspective on all of that. And with that, maybe I'll just stop there and see if there are any questions. And again, just this whole effort of this resiliency report, I think, is just excellent. And we need to move forward on the recommendations.
Absolutely. Any questions for Mr. Leland? Sir, thank you very much for your work and participation in this panel, and of course, your work on resilience planning. It's important to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Have a great day. And with that, we'll call from Department of Environmental Quality, Palmer Mason, please.
Chair Matthews, Chair Glennis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me Mark Hamlin. He's a water quality specialist with the department, and if there are any technical questions that I can't answer, he's available to do that. I do want to start by thanking the committee for having DEQ come and participate in this discussion. And like the prior speaker said, I think there's great value in the work that the commission did in bringing attention to these issues. So we do want to note that for the record. And we would also agree that minimizing any disruptions to wastewater treatment facilities after an earthquake or any other major disaster are certainly an important goal. But I have to tell you that DEQ's role in all this is very, very limited, mm-hmm. which will probably make my presentation the shortest of all the ones that you've seen. As you know, we're the state's environmental regulatory agency, so we're primarily involved with wastewater from a permitting point of view, making sure that public health and the environment are protected with the operation of wastewater treatment plants. And in doing that, we develop the permit conditions to ensure that. We encourage permittees to ensure that their facilities are engineered to be resilient in the face of an earthquake or other disasters. And we encourage them to have response plans in place, but we do not actually have the authority to compel that. And so there was an earlier presentation that, likewise, I thought was very good from the water and wastewater group that worked with the commission that had a number of recommendations that related to DEQ. But from a wastewater perspective, at least from where our agency sits, we're not in a position to compel facilities to do assessments, have mitigation, have a response plan, that type of thing. So I did want the committee to note that for the record. But when there is a disaster, and this is really the part where DEQ jumps in now, or where we have a current role, is we're involved in providing technical assistance and providing regulatory relief. As it was mentioned a couple of times, we certainly understand if there's a catastrophe of the order that we're talking about, it will take a long time for people to get beyond the basics of you know, going and doing the assessment of the damage, reassembling the facilities, getting it back up to the different levels of operation before they have to worry about environmental compliance. So we understand that will come down as sort of the last step in the process. I mean, nobody wants pollution in the environment. Nobody wants pollution to affect public health, but we understand there's other priorities first. So we from that perspective, that's the regulatory relief, the waivers and permitting and that type of thing that we would be working through. And really, that's our primary role in the process. So I can stop and take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Senator Martin Sanders.
My family moved to Gresham in the 40s, and our first house had a well. And then as it developed, of course, city water came by, so we capped that well. I know Gresham High School has a couple of wells, and I don't know if they still use it for the sprinkling system or if they have capped it. If we go into a disaster, is there any, are those wells, could they be reactivated, or would they... You know, it'd be nice to know.
Senator, so I assume your question is about reactivating them for purposes of drinking water,
yeah.
and that type of thing.
Yeah.
That wouldn't really fall in our wheelhouse.
So we'd have to get a permit to use it or not?
That would be Oregon Health Authority. They regulate drinking water. We regulate water quality. So you can ask them. So.
All right.
He's excited. He gets to answer the question.
See, I tried to.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people be trying to get water wherever they can. And, you know, yeah, wells is one option. And, you know, on the other hand, I think the power is going to be out.
Yeah.
So I don't think the well's going to run.
So they won't run.
Until the power comes back on.
Yeah.
So I, you know, but, you know, that said, you know, it's again about resilient communities, maybe thinking ahead about, so suppose the public water system is out. What else is around?
No, if you get, if you used? Have it, well,
yeah,
even
yeah.
a generator. Well,
yeah.
you never
but
know.
But then you don't have fuel. So you might have fuel for a while,
yeah.
and then you're out
yeah.
of fuel, and then what do you do? So,
okay.
Yeah, it's a real challenge, but, yeah.
Questions? Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Palmer, if you have any ideas that you think we'll need for legislation, that I'm hoping you'll come forward with that, too, and be a part of the Resilience Task Force.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Boone, absolutely. Yeah.
Whether you're named or not.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions for the panel? Yes.
I just had an idea that I thought maybe it would be good to put out there since Mr. Leland brought that up, too, is there are all kinds of different alternative energy sources and resources that people could utilize mm-hmm. From rainwater collection mm-hmm. to solar to, you know, whatever. So those are things, and those systems are smaller and smaller, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Communities could work together to do that. And again, I tell everybody this, you're almost going to think I'm weird, but the Stockholm International Water Institute does hold that water forum every year, and it's been focused the last 3 or 4 years on third world countries and their issues, and that's exactly what we're going to be dealing with. So it would behoove you all to look into that, find these other things that we don't even consider using because we're so sophisticated. But once this thing hits, we're going to be down there like, you know, the rest of the world that's in bad shape right now.
That
includes the health issues. Mm-hmm. And there are some very simple applications to keep people safe and to provide water, which is the source of all life.
Say... We have now we're you triggered something else, and I know we're on a time constraint, but you know, I have solar on my house. Okay, I'm putting actually a lot of electricity out into the grid, but I wouldn't be able to use that, or would I? I don't know enough about my own system if I would still be able to have electricity with my own solar system.
Storage.
Yeah, you would.
Mm-hmm.
I would. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
if there's no grid to put it into, you'll have it at your house.
Yeah. At the same time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Is that?
Very good. Well, I appreciate everybody coming forward and testifying over the course of the 3 days of these informational meetings. It's very productive, and I really do appreciate that. I do hope that we concur on Senate Bill 33 and we move that forward. 17-member task force. I know that not everybody will hold a seat, but everybody will have somebody that they look to. For example, there's one person from the scientific industry. Okay, now what does that mean? But we'll figure all that out. And this will be 17 members that are going to be designated to deal with this and bring back a report. So looking very much forward to that. Did you have any closing remarks you'd like to make?
No, it's just been so interesting. I'm glad that we're doing something, but I just feel like we're not going fast enough. It's all at this level, and I want to get down to the implementation stage. So, but thank you, everyone.
Closing remarks, Representative Escobel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. What this does to me is it brings to light the what-if scenario. We go along and we buy our groceries at a grocery store, and we turn on the gas and it's there, and turn on the tap and the water's there, and we flush the toilet and it's gone. You always have to ask yourself, what if none of that were available? How could I fare? The ones that are going to be hurting will be the ones within the larger municipalities and the urban areas. Rural Oregon will probably get along just fine. But what you have brought to light, and I hope that people listen to this very closely, you brought to light that one, the first thing you need to do is you need to have water, because you can only go 3 days without water. The second thing, you need food, shelter, so on and so forth. But I hope that people pay attention to what has just been said here, because if you aren't prepared somewhat, you may be a statistic, and you have to be very careful, because something could, bad could happen to where you would have to survive up on your own instincts.
Anybody else? Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I second that, Representative Esquivel. It's incumbent on everybody to educate themselves, too, and for us to help it with that effort, but to prepare, to everybody to be prepared. And, you know, God forbid, the last thing you're going to do, we're all get his cell phone number, because we're going to call a firefighter.
Just dial 911.
No electricity, though.
Representative Witt, did you have anything to add?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think that this emphasizes the need for us to not only have our communities prepared, as we heard in the earlier meetings, moving critical infrastructure to higher ground now, having evacuation plans, those sorts of things. But I think feeding off of what my colleagues have just said, the importance of for each of us to be individually prepared, to have our families prepared, probably aren't a lot of people that have 3-plus weeks worth of food stored, an equal amount of water stored. That's going to be critical, and that's assuming that we even have our homes and whatnot to live in, and things may be pretty rough. I mean, I'm not so sure that the average Oregonian has contemplated how do I and my family and my neighbors all survive when it's 30 degrees out at night, it's rained for the last 2 weeks, everything is soaking wet, and I don't have a way to either eat or to even provide basic warmth, fire, to warm and dry myself. The prospects are devastating, and I don't think that we have really taken the time, either as a state or as individuals, to contemplate what level of preparedness we need to be prepared for. I honestly do not think that the average person is prepared to live outside for several weeks in the pouring down rain. It would be devastating.
I appreciate that. And what I will say is I think the biggest challenge continues to be to get people to understand the message and to believe that it could happen to them. And that's in a small emergency, which I'll call it small, despite if it happens to you, it's catastrophic, but would be a small fire in their home. You know, just trying to get people to understand that safety is their responsibility and that some things are preventable. In the case of natural disaster, not so much. But in terms of everyday living, there are a lot of disasters that are preventable. And trying to get people to understand where the gas shutoff is, how to, you know, mitigate maybe an emergency with their water situation. It can be difficult. And one of the challenges is how do you get the message out there? In a declining economy, ads cost money. Everything does. Trying to spread that information, then once you get it done, having somebody actually read it and retain it. Those are challenges. And they will be challenges that we'll, again, stumble through as a task force. And I think that this was a good stepping stone. I commend the Senate for agreeing to have joint meetings and having this idea because, quite honestly, just one meeting apiece was not enough to get information out there to start digesting so that we could get something like Senate Bill 33 to move. And so I just commend you all for that. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness on behalf of the House.
I never opened.
You can close it.
But I will close the informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness.
And I think also that, members, this is our last meeting as a group for the veterans, the House Committee of Veterans, unless we have a call of the chair, which I don't anticipate doing. And I imagine it's yours, too. I want to just say, again, to anybody that participated in this process throughout the session. We did great work collectively, House and Senate, and it wasn't by ourselves. We had great help from Elizabeth Edwards, our committee administrator, and also
Cheyenne Ross
for the Senate, and also the assistance of Ashley Clark on the Senate side, Shelley Raskus here today, Mike Riley on the House side with Jenny Craig periodically. And again, just a real honor to work with these fine folks that keep this system moving and coordinate our efforts. So thanks all that participated and all that testified. Look forward to working with you in the interim in some capacity on this plan, and look forward to seeing what we bring back for this body to act on, because let's face it, we are not as prepared today as we wish we were, and we can move on this rather quickly, and the citizens will appreciate it, even though they might not think it's going to happen to them. Thanks so much, and anything else you'd like to add?
I enjoyed serving on this committee. On the Senate side, we were very bipartisan. It was run by Chair Boquist, and then we had a very bipartisan group, and that's one thing about this, the issues that we deal with, they're very bipartisan in nature.
Thanks again, everybody, and with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness.